Alternate Take. I'm your host, Danny Rodriguez. Welcome back to the show. On this episode, man, we dove deep. It was an incredible, incredible episode. We got to speak with retired Port Authority Police Officer William Jimeno and psychologist Mr. Michael Motes. And together, they co-wrote a book called Sunrise Through the Darkness. And the book is based off Mr. Jimeno's experience on 9/11, which is today. Today's September 11, 2023. And Will Jimeno was one of the responders that entered the building when it collapsed. He survived miraculously. A lot of his partners did not. And his story is actually was told on a movie, World Trade Center, which stars Nicolas Cage, and he's portrayed by Michael Pena. An amazing movie and an amazing job done by Oliver Stone in that movie. But it only felt right to have this guy on, man. You guys know what this podcast is all about. And it was truly inspiring to talk to Will. He's very well-spoken. He's very honest about his experiences, about what he went through after the event. I feel like a lot of his book is a lot of it is about that, about what happened to him after the event and how he processed it all and how he finally came to the point where he admitted he had PTSD and what he did about it. And it was a long journey for him to get to be where he's at now. And super glad to call him a friend, man. But it was an honor to talk to both of these men, man. And I don't really want to step on what they had to say. So without further ado, I bring to you guys retired Port Authority police officer William Jimeno and psychologist Michael Motes. What's up, everybody? This is Alternate Take. Welcome back for another episode. We brought you guys two phenomenal guests. I brought you guys retired Port Authority police officer William Jimeno and clinical psychologist Mr. Michael Motes. How you both doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's great to have you guys both. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. Like I was talking about this podcast with my buddies and how far it's come and, you know, the amazing people I've got to interview so far. And as I was talking about that, I think I hung up the phone and I went to YouTube and I just started watching the free movies option. And one of the movies that popped up was World Trade Center. And I hadn't seen it in a while. And for some reason, I don't know what it was, but it kind of made me, I really wanted to tune back into it once again. And I don't know. I don't even know the reason why, to be honest with you, but maybe it was like a yearning for, you know, emotion during that time. I mean, it was obviously an insane time for everybody, but I don't know why I wanted to watch it specifically that day, but I did. And I got so curious after more so than when the first, cause the first time I was a young kid and, you know, this time being who I am now with the podcast and whatnot, I was curious and I did so much research and I looked into you, Mr. Jimeno, and, you know, your fallen partners, and I came across, your book, you know, that you co-wrote with, Mr. Motes over here. And I read the book. It's, incredible for all of you guys out there. Make sure you go get a copy. I'll put a link in the description. But man, I was enamored with the story. I was definitely, it brought a level of human element to it that I didn't, necessarily foresee. I was, you see the movie, but then when you see the actual story, it's crazy how accurate the movie was and storytelling. It's almost like they just took your words out of your mouth and just put it on the big screen. That being said, I always like to start off every interview with a little bit of background. I feel like it's the best way for my audience to get to know who I'm talking to. So, I'll start with you, Mr. Motes. Give us a little background, sir, and tell us who you are and how you got into this.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm as you said, clinical psychologist out of Colorado Springs. You know, my passion has been helping people throughout life, and psychology happened to be just the best fit. It just was the most meaningful fit for me, and in it, I primarily focus on grief and trauma, and with especially with Colorado Springs having like 5 military installations and being second to DC with government contracting, and it's the second largest city in Colorado. We have our fair share of of trauma and first responder trauma that we face. And not only is it the first responders that I tend to work a lot with, but I work with their spouses, which we'll get into in a little bit, which was an important part of the book. And as far as how it kind of even maybe came together a little bit, and I'll let Will talk more to this piece, but Will and I met post 9/11 through a series of just connections. And again, we'll get into this a little bit more probably. And we've been friends for, I guess, over about 20 years now. And he gave me a call one day and said, "Hey," he said, "Mike," he goes, "you know, I've always wanted the rest of the story to come out." And he said, "You know, the movie did a great job of that day and really kind of showing the lives of us and up to the point of being able to, you know, be pulled out of the hole." And he said, "But there's so much more to the story that, you know, I fought for 13 hours in that under that ground. There was so much more fight that had to come later." And it resonated with me with what I watch in my practice. And he said, "You know, what do you say?" And I said, "Yeah, let's do this." And it was too important of a message. And of course, the fact that Will lived it and it comes through very natural, because it's not a rehearsed or regurgitated. It's true life just coming out. And we have some similar philosophies in honoring as many people as we can, because it was each person that steps into someone's life. You never know the impact you're going to have. So each person that visited him, each family member, each, you know, everyone, even in the hole at the time, going into the building, every single one of those actions, you didn't know what the impact was going to be. But it's about investing in each other and honoring each other, whether they're here or not.
Wow. Beautiful. Thank you so much. Mr. Jimeno, a little background on your answer.
All right. So let's start off by, and I think Mike will agree with me. Just call me Will, and he's Mike. We're no different than anybody else, and I really want that message to come across. But so Will Jimeno here, retired Port Authority police detective with the Port Authority Police in New York, New Jersey. Came here from Colombia at 2 years old as an immigrant. Was raised to remember my heritage from Colombia, but that this is our country. Loved this country, was raised here, gave back through joining the Navy after high school, served as a gunner's mate on the USS Tripoli. But my dream since a child was always to be in law enforcement. I wanted to help people, basically. After a long trials and tribulation trying to get on the job up here in the Northeast, where it's well paid, especially the Port Authority, it's a very, very sought after position. I was blessed to get on that job, and I got to live my dream. Unfortunately, on September 11th, like many of my fellow brothers and sisters, sometimes during the course of our law enforcement careers, we are faced with certain challenges, and some of those challenges unfortunately injure us or take our lives. And on September 11th, that's what happened to us, the Port Authority Police. You know, we lost 37, the most in law enforcement history in one day, followed by our brothers and sisters at the NYPD with 23, and of course the FDNY 343 firefighters and the countless civilians. But, you know, I was lucky enough to survive. A lot came through that survival that evening that I, you know, I do speaking engagements. And during my speaking engagements, which I started in 2003, really to young school children, it evolved from grammar schools to high schools, then to law enforcement academies, fire academies, and onto the military, and then to the general public, which I don't do for a living. I kind of pick and choose who I want to talk to. But it was in about 2009, the war was still raging in Fallujah. Went to speak, make a long story short, and of course, we talk about it in the book. Address certain military personnel who were there and who had seen combat, unfortunately. And I shared with them my struggles with PTSD and how I was able to learn to live with it. That was something that was taught to me by my therapist that actually helped me, because I went through a lot of therapists. The following year, one of those individuals came back and shared with the class at the very end on how my words had helped him from committing a bad deed, if you know what I mean. And that really really moved me. And he is the one that said, you know, you need to write a book, because, you know, he opened my eyes to the fact that all of us, whether you, when you serve your country, whether in the military, as first responders, as doctors, nurses, you know, we go through trauma, we see things. And if you're in an incident and you survive, a lot of times people want to say, hey, you're a hero, and that's great and all. But, you know, that time that you're in the news, when the incident happens, you get all that attention. What happens, you know, 3 weeks, 6 months, a year later, when you're by yourself and you're dealing with certain demons, and people don't want to talk about it? You know, we have a high suicide rate within our military, within law enforcement. And, you know, just being able to know that I was able to help one fellow American, one individual, one human being, to stop doing something bad, you know, in their life, was the really the catalyst for me wanting to do this book. And it was very hard to do it at first. It took me a long time, because there is the movie World Trade Center, but I was trying to tell the different publishers, it's not about that. Yes, it encompasses that, but it's really the aftermath, what many of our soldiers, for first responders and so on, go through. And, you know, that's what I wanted to reach out to, because there's always a huge story after an incident that nobody talks about. And I think it's very important. And then I was having trouble, and, you know, COVID kind of hit, and the 20th anniversary was coming. And, you know, me, like I said, Mike mentioned, you know, we've been friends for a long time. And I just said, you know, I knew Mike had written books with a company, publishing university, Professors Press. And I just said, hey, Mike, you know, I trust you. I know his background. He's a very kind man, very open, you know, a guy you could talk to. And I just basically said, Mike, I want to write a book where I share my story, but more importantly, the aftermath. But I want it to be a book that anybody who's suffering, who's, as we say, in a dark place, can pick it up, read it, listen to my words, but more importantly, intertwine something from the from Dr. Michael Moltz's psychology background, but don't make it boring. You know, I feel that's how I was when I was going to talk to a psychologist. A lot of times I was turned off. You know, I just, it's too much mumbo jumbo. And Mike hit the nail right on the head. Everybody who gives me feedback talks about how, hey, how well Michael has done in giving exercises, explaining things that are easy. So our book is not a big book, but it's a book that's effective. And we've been blessed to have so much feedback. I mean, I remember telling Mike that I got an email from a doctor, and she's saying how three of her patients have benefited from the book. And it's a doctor that deals with women postpartum. Never did I think I was going to reach out to women with postpartum. So the book is, of course, is meant for our military, our first responders, but really anybody in general who's been through any type of trauma, whatever that can be, you can name it. And that's what I call trauma or bad things in your life, just evil, darkness. And, you know, we deserve better. And, you know, with the help of Michael, we were able to write this book, and it's been something that we're very proud of, and we know we made a difference.
You know, it's interesting to hear you guys both echo the same message of how trauma is applicable in almost any situation. I just interviewed Mr. Matthew Wiz Buckley. He's a Top Gun pilot for the Navy. And his primary mission is that he runs a foundation called No Fallen Heroes. Their practices are a little different. A lot of it's through psychedelics and whatnot. It's very interesting. But he explained to me very explicitly, he's like, a lot of times we try to, and you mentioned in your book too as well, I read that part where you essentially say that there's no competition in trauma. I think there's a lot of times where you see people do that. It's kind of weird that people do that. I think it's kind of strange. It's kind of like, maybe it's an egotistical thing. Mr. Moats, maybe you can speak on that. But like, when people try to compare traumas, what happened to me was worse than what happened to you, yada, yada, yada. And the reality is, I don't know if the human brain is that complex to even really understand what's worse. I think you just know what you know, and then you deal with it in your own sort of way. And in my head, I didn't know what trauma was when I was a kid, but in the way I always pictured it, in my head, like the extreme versions of trauma was, I always used, there's a scene in Metallica's music video called One, where they portray a guy who just came back from the war, and he has no arms, no legs, and he can't hear and he can't see. And the song is reminiscent of that. He's like, I can't remember anything. I can't see anything. And he's going through this crazy hell where I'd rather just die almost. I've always kind of pictured it that way. Like, I don't know if that's just like a easy way to do it for me, but that's just how I've always pictured it. But am glad that you guys are both here to speak on it, because it's a tag team duo that it's beautiful for me to see. It's the real life Good Will Hunting and Robin Williams put together. You need to have the person who's experienced the trauma and the one who knows in order to diagnose it. And it's a great duo. And I'm glad you guys are both here. Will, I wanted to ask you something. What do you think it was, or what do you think it is specifically about? Cause I know a lot of people like you, especially like Latin Americans, for like first generation, that are so drawn to the career of law enforcement. I don't know what, if it, maybe it was like in the 70s or 80s. I have uncles and cousins and friends of cousins a lot. And it's like, they echo a lot of the same thing you just said, where they said like, it's their dream. Like they want, like they grew up and they knew there was no, I want to be a pro baseball player. There's no, I want to be, you know, anything else. It was, I want to be rich. It was, I want to be a police officer. And that specific career, like it wasn't even firefighters really, which is an amazing profession in itself. But I don't know why specifically I always heard that echoed. But what was it in you that always wanted to be a police officer?
Well, I think a lot had to do with my mother. She was very caring, always willing to help people. Not that my father wasn't, because my father's helped many people. But I think it's also something in the Hispanic community. We love community. We like to help each other. And you're right. You don't see a lot of Hispanic firefighters back then. There's more today. But the same thing. We're helping our community. For me, I could tell you right now, I was a young kid. I fell down the stairs, knocked myself out. My mom called the Hackensack Police Department. They were very paramilitary in Hackensack, New Jersey, back in the 70s. And I mean, when I woke up, there was this tall police officer with a sharp uniform, with his hat on, and I just thought it was a superhero. And right from that moment, I knew that's what I wanted to be. And it was something that always just was in my heart to help people, you know. And you're right, I never did it for the money. I was blessed to get on a great police department with great benefits, great salary. But I never did it for the money. I did it because I really wanted to help people. And I was blessed to have a wife that supported me, which is very important. You know, we talk about that in the book. It's basically you figure out that, hey, you know, you're not only on the job, your family's attached to you. They live it too. But that was really the big thing for me, is I just wanted to help people. You know, there's a feeling that I can't even describe of helping someone, knowing that you made a difference in someone's world, you know. And like I always say, you don't have that many days on this earth. You know, if you're lucky to live to 365, you know, take that and multiply by 90. If you're lucky to live till 90 years old, take the 365 times 90. Look at how many days you have on this earth. Part of that time, we're born in diapers. And if we're lucky to get to 90, sometimes we're back in diapers. So it's not a lot of days on this earth. So you try to make the best of it, try to live a good life, try to make an impact in someone else's life, because hopefully that person will also make a positive impact in another person's life. And I feel that's how we make the world a better place.
Absolutely. Michael, I wanted to get your take on this. As a clinical psychologist, there's a part in the book in the beginning where you're describing the events of that day. And I was very, I highlighted the part of the book. I was very intrigued by it, where Will, you said, you guys were in the bus and you guys are going into the city and you can already see what looked like to be dead bodies already on the sidewalks and people panicking. And then you said in the book, you said, but nonetheless, it was time to go to work. And then that phrase to me just really stuck out. I felt like, wow, what a like fight or flight response. And like in the middle of chaos as a rookie officer with, you know, so many other things to worry about, like your wife at home was pregnant and everything. And you immediately thought it's time to go to work. And I wanted to get your perspective on that, Michael, on where that comes from. Where does that fight or flight come from? Instinct come from? How is it stronger in some people? And what's your take on that? It's very interesting to me.
Sure, sure. And that's just one of the things is, you know, we all have our gifts, right? We all have our strengths and but one of the most important things that I find in that is meaning. When we have a meaning or a passion, I think it was Dostoevsky had said, he who has a lived why to live for can endure almost anyhow. And, you know, when I talk to my special forces buddies and I say, you know, courage doesn't show up until you're afraid. Every one of them will usually silently, but they'll go, you know, because it's just, it's not that they're not afraid. It's not that you're not scared to do this. It's just the calling that is within you is so meaningful that it overrides the fear to, you know, that where most people are going to turn and go the other direction. It feeds you and just says, I have to, I can't go the other direction because I can't live with myself in that. And I think of the same, I think of nurses and doctors. Last thing I want to see is someone sticking a needle in someone's arm or cutting them open to do surgery, or that just grosses me out. But for them, it's, they can get in the nastiest of injuries and just be in there cleaning and pulling tissue because it's their calling. Will can go into a building that's on fire, you know, and, you know, some people will ask me, how is it that I sit and listen to some of the stuff that I listen to? Because one of my favorite jobs was hospice. But one of the things that you will find is when it is your calling, in the midst of those darkest times, if you're willing to go in there, you will also see the most beautiful things. But you will never see them unless you're willing to go in. And it's a matter of repeat. You know, you get stronger with each event that you have to deal with. But I don't think it's ever easy. I think it's just that your calling is so strong. It just helps you to overcome that flight. Whereas, again, you show me a nurse who's sticking a needle in someone's arm and you're going to see me squirming and turning my head, and because it's just, it's too much.
Yeah, it's so interesting, you know. And I think what you said, you hit the nail right on the head where you said it's their calling. It's something that they're drawn to do. They have to do it. They can't live with themselves because, you know, it's not only evidence of the Marines that came to save you, Mr. Menno, or Will, I'm sorry. But I saw it personally, at least within my own life. You know, I was over here in California. I was in third grade. It was a very vivid day for me. School started at 7:45 in the morning. So, I mean, by the time I woke up for school, the two towers already been hit. But my mother's a nurse and my father's in law enforcement. So seeing their reaction was very shocking to me because, you know, they're very stable people. You know, my mom's, she's a crazy Latin mom. So she's always pretty. She's pretty wild most of the time. But when it came to her job, she was very focused and, you know, knew how to get the job done. She was an operating nurse and all that stuff. So, but I think a lot of that, what you just said, was in them. I think especially for first responders at that time, being across the country, you felt completely helpless. And I think that's what bothered them the most. I think that's what bothered most people the most, is that, like, I can't go help. I'm in this line of work just like them. Those are my brothers. And even though they're in New York and I'm in California, I there's nothing I can do except sit here and just and watch. And it's just it's a helpless feeling, you know, and it's insanely commendable for the people that know how to turn that on and know the risks. Specifically, speaking about your partners, Will, you know, Pazulo and Rodriguez and Amoroso. I mean, the scenes in the movie, just, they do such a crazy job of depicting what happened. I mean, that's one thing I actually wanted to touch upon. And I was nervous about asking this too, because I felt like, well, is that like scraping a scab? Am I like asking a question that's a little too personal? But so I'm glad you're here, Michael, as well, because I feel like it can be diagnosed a little bit better. But when you guys get to the towers, and you guys are walking in, and the scenes are very eerie. Like, they do, I don't know, the directors did an amazing job, but how much did that scene where the towers are collapsing, how much did that really bring back what was going on at that time? Because just for, as a viewer who wasn't across the country at the time in third grade, it felt like the most real thing to me. I don't know if it was just an amazing job by the cinematographers or what, but it really broke me for a while. There's very few scenes in movies that break me. That broke me 100%. How was that experience reliving that, watching that movie, for you?
Well, you know, first of all, thank you for those kind words. I know Oliver Stone and all the actors and producers that put this movie together would really appreciate that. And I told Oliver back then, sometimes back in 2006, you know, it's different than today. Today, 9/11 happened yesterday. They didn't make a movie today and everybody would accept it. Back then, it was hard for people. But we felt that, you know, telling the truth is important. It's important for future generations to see that. And what you said before is the movie really came right out of our mouths. We just told them what happened. They just translated it right to the screen. And I mean, you can go back to our interviews in 2002. It's the same story. And it's a human story. That's what I think is important, is that we're able to share with everybody. Going back to what you were asking about the scenes, you know, it was difficult. I was on set a lot. And that particular scene you're talking about where the collapse happened, I actually got physically ill. They had built in Culver City, California, they had built the movie set. And when I was there, I was on set when they were filming that particular scene. I literally got physically ill, and Oliver had to stop because I literally was crying and almost throwing up because that I felt like I was there. It was very difficult for me, but at the same time, I felt that as a survivor, I always felt that my job is to make sure that nobody forgets, to talk about my teammates, to talk about really about the human race. You went back to saying something earlier, you know, and Michael said it. It takes courage to overcome your fears, but also when you go past those fears, you actually see the beauty of what you're doing. On 9/11, people ask me, what's the most you saw of that day? What was the worst? And I said, well, I'm not going to speak to the worst. What I saw was the most love. Total strangers from different background, races, colors, political agendas, all helping each other. I saw how we came together as human beings. And that movie did that. But they did such a great job that I actually got physically ill. And there were times that Oliver would ask me, I think the craziest thing he asked me was they actually put Michael Peña, who plays my part, in that spot. They actually built the hole. And they had a piece that would come down. They would crane it down and bury Michael. And I remember I was standing there, and actually people got upset with Oliver. But we had such a great relationship. I just told him, listen, man, just I'm Will, you're Oliver, let's get this done. And he asked me, he goes, can you lay in there just like it was, and we're going to bring this down, and you tell me if it's real? That was difficult. I mean, you know, and I thought about it for a second, like, no, I don't want to do this. I never, ever want to relive that. But then I also felt that, you know what, if you want people to understand what happened down there, you have to do your part. And I did. It was very difficult. And actually, some of the people there, the producers, were getting mad at him for asking me to do this. But I said, you know what? I'm okay with it because I want it to be as accurate as possible. And what we did to make the film more accurate was actually bring our real rescue workers that pulled us out, both me and my sergeant, John McLaughlin, because we felt that, okay, I can tell you from my perspective what happened. I can't tell you from their perspective, which made the film even better because Scott Strauss, who led my operation, Patty McGee, those two gentlemen, as well as Chuck Sharika, the paramedic who was civilian, came off the street. They talked to the producers. They were involved so they could give their point of view. And that's what made the film for me great, was that it was from the point of view from each person, including our wives. But we all gave. It was difficult to make the movie because we had to relive things that nobody wants to relive, the bad stuff, you know. But we felt that it was something that was important for future generations. And but they did a great job, and it was tough.
It's incredible. Jesus. Mike, I want to ask you, too, you know, kind of touching on what Will just spoke about, reliving the experience. I feel like it's naturally just a lot tougher for people in the line of work that Will was in, whether it be a first responder or any sort of law enforcement. And you guys touched on in the book a little bit. You guys said, you know, that like these are people that naturally help people. So like for them to ask for help is a tough thing. But it's strange because like you would like in other like, let's say, the field of in the creative industry, like musicians are very good at talking about their traumas, and they can make it palatable for everybody. And like that's something they do naturally. And then they may not be able to do the courageous things that Will can do. Like, and that's the trade-off, is both people can kind of learn from each other. How was it for you engaging in those steps? I mean, watching Will, you know, go through this process all over again. I mean, watching a movie of the most traumatic thing that happened to him and going, don't worry, this is how it's going to go. Or, you know, how was it on your end watching from the outside in, thinking how it would, the steps that would follow?
Yeah, it was definitely different watching the movie, because when I originally watched it, it was, you know, obviously early on, long before we were ever thinking of the book. And of course, I remember watching the events unfold when I was getting ready for work. And so there was, you know, watching again, and then, and of course, Will and I have talked about different stories and so forth along the way. So it wasn't just brand new for me, but there was a, there was a different, I guess, maybe dedication to not just being an observer of the trauma, but really more the, again, the professional of the companion to the trauma, which is, there's a lot of respect and a lot of, I guess, sensitivity to even checking in with Will, even though he's done all his own work and he's, you know, wanted to do the book and so forth. It never stopped the fact that I still, that part of me comes out. So we're actually kind of feeding off of each other in a way, because Will's still being a law enforcement officer of trying to educate and serve the public by telling his story. In the same vein, I'm trying to kind of also monitor where he's at as we're talking a little bit, and just see if there's any, you know, any hot buttons or what have you. So yeah, it definitely different coming around to write the book. I even contacted a couple other colleagues that I had, both first responders and people in the helping field like myself, just to see if there's any blind spots that I had or any other input that they had that I might be missing or that could add into that piece. Because yeah, it was just way too important of a topic. You'd asked earlier about when you were watching the film, and you said, how is it that that can really hit you like that? So is it just that they're good cinematographers or what? Definitely great cinematographers. But that's not just the case. That's not the only part. One is we all can relate. You don't have to have been in the World Trade Center to relate to a sense of helplessness, to relate to a sense of fear, you know, absolute gut-wrenching empathy for the people that are in there, regardless of who they are. And so by them being able to display it so well, it can tap into those pieces for you without having been in it, that you can identify, you can connect, you can, you know, and Will will talk to this, you know, he's done it many times where we all have our World Trade Centers. It doesn't matter what the symbol is we all have them. And so even if you hadn't been the one to go through that, it's going to trigger you. For people like for Will, when he was watching the set and seeing it, doing it, was triggering him. We have what we call kind of, or at least I call them, trauma roots. So it's kind of like anytime you tap that, it doesn't matter. You can be sitting in the safety of your home, nothing going on. It can be 30 years later, because trauma is not time sensitive, and you can have a certain smell hit you that just reminds you. And if it hits that root, it's going to pull stuff up. And that's why for Will, it was, he consciously knew I'm on a set and I'm safe, but he was being so overwhelmed by the sensations, the memories, all the same reactions. He had, in essence, he had one foot in the present and he very much had one foot in the past. He was living it again. And that's part of the difficulty with trauma, is it can become so overwhelming that we behave differently, we act differently, we get rewired differently. There's a lot of things that can happen to us. And that's why it's really an important piece to try to help when you're helping people to keep one foot in the present while you're working at the other, so that you don't get so sucked into it. Because that's what we call flooding. It's kind of like saying, you want to learn to swim and I take you and just kick you out of the boat. It's too panic ridden for you to actually learn anything. So I don't know if I answered all your questions. I kind of bounced to two spots there.
No, that was great. That was perfect. It is ironic, the idea that law enforcement can run into a problem so fast. But when it comes to running at trauma, it's tough. That's harder for them than it is to run into a situation that's very violent. You know, I think it's crazy. I just had a buddy recently, a good friend of mine. He was shot in the face last year, survived. He's doing well. But, you know, I've struggled having conversations with him. You know, we hang out all the time, and we'll have beers. And, you know, I kind of just wait for him to open up to me more than me kind of, you know, ask him questions. Maybe I got to do a better job at that. But, you know, I can't imagine, you know, it's just a tough thing. It's a tough thing to deal with. And not only that, Will, I your perspective in the book that I found the one of the most interesting for sure, that was like gut-wrenching for sure, was when you were talking about the events of the day and you said you wouldn't take any of it back. And then you also said that you felt a sense of survivor's guilt, knowing that these small little events that the movie portrays, you know, where your partner takes the cart for you, or, you know, the guy who's like, no, I got hit in the face with a cement rock, but that doesn't matter. I'm Christopher Amoroso. I'm going to stay here and I'm going to help out. Dominic Pizzullo having the chance to leave and then coming back and, you know, doing what he did and saying, make sure no one forgets that I try to save you guys. It's deep stuff. And I remember you mentioning in the book that like that bothered you at some point because you felt these deep issues troubling you within the following years of the events. And you would think about your partners and maybe there was a party that realized you weren't living the best way you could live to honor them. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, my survivor's guilt was immense back then. And I don't say I have survivor's guilt right now, but I don't forget. And there are still days. I just said to my wife the other day, I spent the day doing nothing. I said, I wasted a day. I let the guys down. We're human beings. We're going to make mistakes. We're going to get into routines. Back then, it was difficult. Why? Because the question is, why am I alive? You know, my friends, my partners died. They have families, kids the same age as mine. And I always tell people, I came to terms with saying, you know, the only person who's going to answer that is God. If I'm lucky enough to get into heaven, I try to do the best I can now, and I try to help others. I know that if I didn't make it, I would want them to have a good life. And that comes from my heart. I mean, even my wife, I told her, I didn't think about my family till pretty much I thought it was over. You know, the second building was coming down. That's when I thought of my family, because it was always my job first, because I took an oath. And I tell young children and police officers and firefighters in the academy is, if you're going to go into this line of work, people are counting on you, you know, and you are the line between good and evil. You know, I take that to heart. You should be a professional in whatever you do. And you should really find a profession that you feel is not a job. It's something that you enjoy. But the survivor's guilt was very immense on me. And it really was at the heart of the PTSD. For me, it was anger, you know, and Michael can talk to this, you know, PTSD comes so many different forms from, you know, anger, depression, anxiety. Mine was anger. I was angry at what happened to me. What happened to my family? What happened to my partners? What happened to America? But at the same time, I realized that, you know, people have to understand the world is going to continue no matter what. So we have to make it a point to try to live a fruitful life and to be able to share our experiences, no matter how big they are, no matter how small they are, because it's going to help somebody else. You know, through me speaking, I'm seeing that I'm able to help other people, but I had to actually help myself first. You know, it's just like on a plane. You got to put that oxygen mask on yourself before you can help another person. So it's very important for anybody who's listening to me, no matter what profession you're in, especially military and law enforcement, who are so close to my heart, that, you know, you have given so much of yourself to your country, to your community. You deserve to be happy. I want people to understand that. And that's something I had to come to grips with, that, you know, the survivor's guilt was eating at me. But at the same time, through therapy and being supported by my family, that, yeah, I deserve happiness too. And, you know, like Michael said, one of the things that I learned over the years from Mike speaking is that I started realizing that, you know, and I learned this saying from Michael is, tragedies are not competitive. So yes, I had 220 stories hit me. But at the moment that you find out you got cancer, you lost a loved one, it could be even a child. I tell them, if you can't get over a midterm or a test, that's like the World Trade Center falling on you. It's what we do with ourselves. And it's very easy to talk about it. It's very difficult to do it. You know, it's like I tell people, it's like trying to lose weight. You know, I've always been a bigger guy. I got to work hard at it, you know, and it's easy to say, I'm going to do this. But when you got to put it to action, and when it comes to the mental arena, like Michael said, that's something I can't do. I early on after 9/11, you know, I was doing, you know, a couple of years after, I was doing better. And I was asked by our police department to come and talk to other fellow Port Authority police officers who were having a hard time. And I remember thinking to myself, hey, let me go and help. And I went there, and it was so toxic. I mean, there must have been 10 cops there, and what they were spewing was the same stuff I was spewing. And I realized, I'm not good at this. I had to separate myself. even today, I don't watch as much news because this crazy world we're living in with politics and this and that one. I was just talking to somebody recently. I keep a pulse on what's going on, but I don't immerse myself in any type of negativity because I see how it affects me. And because of the PTSD, it could trigger that. And Debbie Mandel, who was the therapist who actually helped me come to light on saying, and I want everybody to understand this, no matter what tragedy you've been to, whatever darkness, you never get rid of that. Whether it's alcoholism, you know, you've been abused, you've been raped, you know, what I went through, you have to learn to live with it. It's, you know, the day I get rid of what happened to me in the PTSD is the day they bury me. I have to learn to live with that. Like Michael said, there's many times, even currently, something could trigger me, either upset me, can get me angry, and I lose control because that's what PTSD do. You'll lose control, and you have to keep that in check. And I've learned that. I've learned it by working my ass off and understanding it and being disciplined with it. My wife has been a big part of that, you know, and I commend Michael because when we wrote the book, that's something that I never thought about. And I learned a lot from my wife. Michael talked to my wife, who doesn't like to talk to anybody, and saw her perspective because something that we all need to learn is that, yes, if you're a police officer, I'll use them as an example. You've been shot, you've been hurt, no matter what, all the focus is on you. But I didn't realize how what happened to me was affecting my family. So secondary PTSD. So there's a lot to learn. And that's what I loved about doing the book with Michael was because he brought so many things, was still teaching me. And that in turn helps us teach other people, you know, that we want to reach on, you know, different aspects of things. So I think it's an important thing. And you're always growing. That's the main thing. You know, don't ever think you know everything because you don't, you know. And especially going back to your point that you had a friend, a fellow officer, a brother of ours that's been shot in the face. Years ago, we had a New Jersey State Trooper who had been shot in the face. And I was honored to be asked to come speak to the New Jersey State Police. They're very paramilitary, very strong agency. But they asked me to come speak about what happened that day, how I recovered, how much I love the job, you know, my passion, my obsession for being a law enforcement officer. And I met this young trooper who had been shot in the face. And I think this is very important because you're right. Talk about ego, talking about macho. You know, he opened up to me, and I've had several officers who have opened up to me from incidents. And his thing was, I can't talk to my trooper buddies. Why? Because it's such a macho environment. A lot of guys, you'll start talking to them and what they'll do, like, oh, if it was me or it's this and that. And I always use this example. Understand something. That's like me telling my wife that I know what it's like to give birth. I will never know that because I have not been in that incident. So when you have a fellow officer who's been in an incident and they open up and they're talking, just listen. Just listen. Be that person who's there to listen. Be that soundboard. That really helped me when I was able to talk to certain individuals that would just listen. I'm not looking for the answer. I'm just looking to get things off my chest to alleviate this baggage that I have. And I think that's a very important thing. And I always say macho is doing what you have to do. For me, which you're reading in the book, what triggered me to realize I had PTSD, because I didn't know I had it. That's the crazy thing. I didn't know what was wrong with me. But when I realized what I put forth was my family, I said, if I'm not a good father, a good husband, it's like the terrorists through me reach out to my family and mess them up, because we know that families who have people who are drug abusers or alcoholics, sometimes those children end up being the same because of examples. And I didn't want to be that. And that was my, what propelled me to saying, you know, I got to tackle this. I got to be man enough to say, let me talk about these things that I'm ashamed. That's how I felt. I felt ashamed. I felt ashamed. I felt the guilt, the survivor's guilt. So I think that it's important that we understand, especially with fellow officers and veterans, that, you know, just make sure you take the time to talk to people. And some people never talk about it. I recently spoke last year to the Air Force, to many of the crew members and pilots of the whole debacle in Afghanistan, where they saw people jumping off the planes. And some of them came up to me after I spoke, said, I've never spoken to anybody about it. They felt a connection with me. And that's why, for my desire with this book, was to be able to reach out to people that were in my place that didn't want to talk about it, was ashamed about it, were lost about it, didn't know who to talk about to. How do you take that first step to find your sunrise? And, you know, thankfully I have Michael, and we've been able to have a great impact with people.
Yeah, definitely. You know, you hit the nail on the head. We were speaking about these macho guys and not being able to do that. Especially in law enforcement, you know, I mean, especially in Hispanics as well. You know, my old man, he said his dad used to always tell him, Fajate, mijo. Fajate, meaning like that's in a fancy way. That means basically put a bandaid on it, like suck it up, something a little bee, essentially. And that's kind of just what you're told your whole life. And that's just not just a Hispanic thing. It's basically anybody that grows up in that kind of tough career. And I think the main thing you said is you're not really ever thinking that someone's willing to listen. I didn't realize till I got older that listening is a skill. It's an absolute skill. Like, you don't think that when you're young, you know, you think the talkers are the skillful ones. Like, oh, the guy, that comedian on stage or that actor or that, whatever, it doesn't matter who it is, the people that speak. But Michael, where did that skill come from? You, is that something that you were just, since you're a kid, you've always wanted to diagnose, that's always been your thing? Have you always been the listening type since you're a kid, or did you develop into that as you got older? Like, where does that passion come from, wanting to listen to other stories and strategically plan to fix them? That's an insane thing.
I grew up in a very caring family. Will knows all my family too. And they were also people just wanted to serve. I mean, just dirty blue collar, down home, community members just want to serve, real basic stuff. And maybe because I was also the youngest, you know, I didn't have the biggest voice. I don't know if that's where part of it came from, but I know sometimes linear part where you're in the family can play a part. But I have always been one that's listened. And when I hear you say diagnose, my field is really big about diagnosing, right? I don't like that part. I think it's a disservice. I think there's an importance to it. Don't get me wrong. There's an importance, but there's way too much reliance on diagnosing. And the word I like to use is understanding. And if you're simply diagnosing someone, you're not listening to them. You're listening to symptoms. You're listening to just categorize, and you're missing the depth of that person, because every little piece in there can shade an event differently. And so really understanding someone and getting to know who they are. I think there's not much more in life that matters. Maybe it's because I got more gray hair now and everything else, but it's the older I get, the more impressed I am with less. Just not a lot impresses me anymore, except relationships. That's the one thing that has really stood the test of time, getting to know people, because each person is a story. Each person has, a depth of experience, and you learn from all of them. And it doesn't matter, again, what race, age, gender, any of that stuff. You learn from all of them when you actually go to sit and listen to them. It's been a passion of mine. Quite honestly, I probably will talk more in this podcast than I do in most of a week. It's just who I am. So even when you talked about your friend, I think, don't be afraid to listen, but ask permission, right? Because no one has an invitation into anyone's pain. But you can, instead of just waiting, you can ask, hey, dude, you ever want to talk about that? You ever feel like just opening up, or is that something you want to keep to yourself? And that's all you're doing is just opening a door. And if someone wants to talk to you, part of the reason we spend so much time talking instead of listening is because we're afraid. We think we have to have an answer. We think we have to have a fix. We think we have to come in with all these wonderful cliches that are going to sound wonderful that we read on Facebook, and it's like, no, understand. Listen to understand their story is more healing than anything you're going to offer. And there's nothing for you to fix. It's theirs. And if there's something for them to fix, they will work on that. Assisting is different, but no, the greatest thing you can do is just listen to understand, not to diagnose, not to judge, not even to respond, just to understand. And if there's a point to come back, there'll be something to say there, but practice that more first in just listening, and seeing how you connect to it. And if there's a clarifying question, ask, you know, and, but again, always be willing to hear them say, no, I'm not talking about that.
Yeah. You know, you hit, you, again, you said it perfectly. We were talking about understanding, you know, and I'm sure you've heard this, these comparisons 100 times with the Good Will Hunting thing, but it's just like the only movie I really think of when it comes to that. But they speak on where Will talks about like, I've had a bunch of people like diagnosing with yada, yada, yada. He's like, and then he's, it turns out Robin Williams is the only one who actually understands him. He's That's the difference. That's what makes him open up to him eventually.
Yeah.
You know, with the, it's not your fault and yada, yada, yada. But, wow, that's amazing. Will, when you speak to these classes, you know, I know law enforcement is a troubling career right now. It's a tough one. I don't see, you look at the news, you see the people that are like not signing up, you know, it's not as revered as it once was. And it's in a, definitely in a pendulum shift. What are the words you give to motivate these people that had dreams like yourself that are entering this career, that are asking you for guidance, or these police departments that are asking you to come back and speak to these new recruits who, you know, are bald, they got their whole these suits on, they're ready to go day one, and you know, they already tell them, hey, you know, once you're done on Monday, you're gonna go chase murderers. You know, what are the words you give to these people?
Well, you know, I'm actually speaking to the Port Authority 121 class next Tuesday, and I talk about faith, hope, and love, three words that were instilled in me by my parents. Faith, I don't preach religion, but if you're a person that has a religion, believe in your faith. And if you don't, have faith in yourself. A hope, you always got to have hope, no matter how bad a situation is, you have to keep hoping. And love for yourself and love for those around you. And those three things I implemented that evening while I was trying to survive. I kept leaning back on all those three things, and that really kept me going forward to survive. And I instill in them that, you know, you're important. What you do, no matter how bad they bash you today. And listen, law enforcement, we're not perfect. Every profession, they're not perfect. Parents are not perfect. So yeah, have we had some bad apples? Absolutely. Every line of work has it, from priests to parents to cops to firefighters, the list goes on. But the reality is there's more good in this world than bad. And I tell them that if they're signing up for this, go out there and be a professional, be the good person, be the person that people, when they call you, can rely on you, you know, and how important it is that their job is. I'm also still happy to say that I still have a lot of young people that somehow, some way recognize me, whether I'm at the shooting range or out in public, and they say, hey, you know, I'm going to be a cop. And believe it or not, especially with the years that we've been through, as a law enforcement community where we're taking a beating, there's still young people that want to become police officers. And that goes to what I feel is there's always more good than bad. And we need the good to counter the bad. That's just reality. It's been with us since the beginning of time. It will continue to be with us till the end of time. So my main thing is just to influence them, share with them what helped me, share with them something hopefully they can take away from my survival, something that they can take away from my recovery, and to inspire them to be someone that children can look up to and say, you know what, just like I did, there's a superhero, you know, and that's really important. That's what I do. That's what I share with them. And I also let them know that every speaking engagement I start off, I say, I'm going to tell you a story. It's a human story. I don't even feel like it's my story. It's just a human story. I'm going to talk. It's going to go through one ear and out the other. I hope that you're listening, you capture something in between those ears that somehow, some way down the line will help you. Because I think when we're smart, no matter what we're doing, as we grow as human beings, people are going to talk and things are going to go through one ear and another. Hopefully we're smart enough to capture something that will help us in every different aspect down the line in our lives. It might not be tomorrow, but it could be 6 years down the line and say, hey, I remember this story. And that's why it's important. I tell everybody, your life, your story is important. Share your story. Share what challenges you have, how you overcame those challenges, because you never know how that's going to help someone down the line. And it doesn't have to be you're buried alive. It could just be, hey, I stunk at algebra. You know, I had to take algebra 3 times in college, but I kept going and I had friends that helped me, you know, and I remember saying, okay, well, let me take what they're teaching me and apply it. And it helped me, you know, so you never give up and you try to, I use the word Rolodex. I'm probably a dinosaur. People don't know what that is, but you know, my memory bank, and say,
hey, I remember I learned something from somebody. Let me take that and put it into effect. And I think that's important.
Wow. Amazing. Michael, sort of the same question. What would you tell officers maybe who have been working for a little bit now and they've gotten through their academy phase, they heard the amazing words of Will, and now they're experiencing, you know, trauma in their first couple of years and they'll, in their later years, almost at the end of retirement, when they're, and they're looking for that final push to come see someone like yourself, what would you tell them to give them the courage to do it?
Yeah. You know, one, I try to normalize, first of all, because our field still, kind of like law enforcement gets a bad rap, our field gets a bad rap in the fact that, you know, you're supposed to be crazy or messed up or this, and it's not. It's, we're all human. We're all trying to figure out how to survive this rock. Some of us have better tools. Some of us have worse experiences. And so I try to normalize what mental health is about, including even like we go to a doctor for, or dentist for teeth cleaning. We go to a doctor for broken arm. There's nothing more than we're just talking to someone to deal with something that we don't have the necessarily tools with, or we have a wound that we just need help in caring for. And I think more than anything, because Will had mentioned it too about, you know, you got to focus on the good. There's both good and bad. Focus on the good. I think of that with law enforcement and meaning, again, is remember why you're doing it. That's the thing that you can, that's the only thing you have power over. You have no power over how society is going to judge you or how the news is going to spin a story. You have no power whatsoever in that. The only thing you have is focusing on remembering why you're there, what you're doing, who you want to be. It's all forward momentum stuff instead of reactive defensive posturing. Because the more you get locked into that reactive defensive posturing, the more you're going to spiral out and you're going to burn out. And quite honestly, you put yourself in more danger as a law enforcement officer because you got too much noise in your head instead of staying, you know, laser focused on what's in front of you. And so I would say, remember who you want to be. Remember, what are your goals as a law enforcement officer? Also know if it's time to get out of the field. There's no shame in that either. It's because if you're not going to take care of yourself in that, you become more of a liability to your partners and society, so to speak. You also become more of a liability to your family. It's remembering what is important to you most. And if that family is most important to you, you're going to do whatever you need to do, including face hard decisions. If whether it's time to go get help or if it's time to, you know, not be a police officer or what have you. And so I think of it as kind of a cash or credit, philosophy, pay now or pay later. But if you pay later, you're paying a lot bigger dividend. And so, you know, start now, recognize that you're not supposed to have all the answers. The stuff that you see, especially as first responders, we're not supposed to see that stuff. And thankfully first responders keep most of us from seeing the majority of it. But it comes at a cost because they don't get to just change their lenses back to what it was before they saw the stuff that they saw and the things that they've experienced. I can no longer, look at someone and think they're just completely a safe person because they have a big smile, because I work with too many pedophiles victims of rape and sex assault and so forth. And it's just, you cannot go back to that. Once your lenses have been, you know, rubbed by the sandstorm, it's just what they are. But you can focus on, back to that forward focus thing, but you can choose to where you put your greatest energy. So I can't ignore the pain, the ugly, the darkness that I see, but I can choose where my greatest focus goes while not forgetting. It is not about making it an or, it's about making room for and, for holding both of those and still choosing where you put your biggest energy. And so that's where I would probably talk to law enforcement officers is, again, remember what's most important to you. Is it your ego or is it your family? And I have a tendency to be able to talk to folks that way because first I listen and I try to build a relationship. And two, I don't know, maybe being an older guy helps too, but, you know, there's just, I can tend to confront people in a way that still says, dude, I got your back, but I'm going to step on your toes here. And, and in that, what I found is most people really do want better for themselves and want to, they want to do right, but they just don't always know how. And that's all of us. There is not a single person that is immune to that. There's no way for us to all have the answers. It's why it's so important to rely on each other. And I'll be honest with you, the people that taught me the most about the field of psychology probably never finished high school. They were dirt broke country kids, but they knew what it meant to live. They knew what it meant to help. They knew what it meant to cry, to serve, to grieve. They knew what life meant. Grad school just gave me some fancy terminology for it.
Yeah, that's so funny. You know, my old man has a phrase about two things kind of related. He always says, like, if you're someone with some sort of problems and you think you're hiding them, but everyone can see them, he calls you like an ostrich. He's like, ostrich, we walk around in the field thinking nobody can see them, but everyone can see it. Like, you're too tall. You're too obvious in the bushes. Like, you know, whether that be, or there's an old phrase, and this one's a little bit more rated R, but he always says, like if you're like an inch away from an elephant, it just looks like a big gray dick. That's all it looks like. Yeah. You can tell it's nothing else.
Exactly.
The guy 10 yards behind you is like, dude, you're in front of an elephant. What are you doing? You know, Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, you can see the problem bigger than you can, essentially. I think that's where you come into play, you know, and you can diagnose those problems better for us, which is an amazing thing. Gentlemen, I can't tell you how much it means to me for you guys to join me today. Is, you know, like I said, I'm just a kid, you know, having a good time, taking a chance, you know, interviewing some of his heroes. And you know, I never thought I'd interview someone like you, Will. I mean, that day has never left me. It's so vivid in my head. You know, I remember everything from that day, and you know, just like everybody else did that day. Everyone remembers that day, you know. And I was only 8, and it still pierces my memory. And you know, to speak to a hero like you from that day is just you know, it's very fulfilling for me. It's hard for me throughout the whole interview to not break down a few times, but I kept it together. But you know, especially you, Michael, for joining me. I think it's amazing. I'm asking you to break down 8 to 10 years of school in 45 minutes. I know how hard that is. And you did a very elegant job doing that. I appreciate it. Thank you, sirs. Thank you guys both for joining the show.
Yeah. My pleasure, Danny. It it's the same thing as I know Will and I both, we've both got a lot of gray hair on us now. And, but we were just kids, you know, venturing out, dreaming about doing things and taking chances too, and following our hearts. So knock yourself out, brother, and don't ever worry about breaking down. It takes courage to have tears. You're actually engaging with life when you do that.
I appreciate you, sir. Thank you. Will, where can the people find you? You know, on Instagram, and where can they get your book and continue to get all the, you know, the great information that I got for all of you guys? It's called Sunrise Through the Darkness, and it's an amazing read.
Well, thanks, Danny, for having us. The book is available at Amazon.com, UniversityProfessorsPress.com. I encourage you to not only pick it up, read it, give it to someone that might need it. And if you read it and you find it to be helpful, please give us a good review, because that's how we spread the word. You know, we've been blessed to be interviewed by a lot of people. We're still plugging along, trying to get the word out, because that's all we can do. You know, and I just want to let everybody out there know that if you're struggling with the darkness, you deserve your sunrise. I don't care what line of work you're in. Of course, to me, military, law enforcement, first responders, doctors, nurses are close to my heart. But, you know, the word hero, I'm not comfortable with. The only person I want to be a hero to is my daughters. But understand that you have the opportunity every single day to be a hero, to influence somebody in a positive way. So, and it's okay to fail. There's days that we make mistakes. There's days we're bad examples. But every new day that you have, which is a gift, is a day that you can make a positive impact in your own life and people around you. So never forget that. Never give up. And it's okay if you're a real macho, hardcore guy to understand that being vulnerable, being able to understand that you're just a human being and that you have emotions, that it's okay to go in the corner and cry. You just have to pick yourself up and move forward and figure out a way, you know? So to all the macho men out there and even macho women, understand macho is doing what you have to do when you have to do. And all I want to do is be able to help you live a better life, because I've been blessed to have a second lease on life.
And if you haven't been through any tragedy, you've pretty much up to this point have won the lottery. But it touches us somehow, some way, maybe not directly, but the loss of a loved one is a huge impact. So understand that the way we remember those that we lost within our families, brothers and sisters in law enforcement, military, and so on, is by living a good life, honoring them, remembering them. And again, I just wish everybody their sunrise through their darkness.
I love that. Gentlemen, thank you so much once again.
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Danny.
This has been Alternate Take. We'll see you guys later. Peace. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Our interview with Mr. Will Jimeno and Mr. Michael Motes. Thank you both guys for joining the show. I had just an amazing time speaking to both of you guys. You guys are heroes in my book, you know, honestly. It's rare you get to talk to people like yourselves. So very, very honored, and I'm glad to call you guys my friends, man. For everybody else out there, man, I put all their links and everything in the podcast description, so go check it out, man. The link to their book is there. It's an amazing book. It was hard not to get emotional reading it, and I definitely did a couple times. But you know, today is just a very crazy day for everybody, you know. And it, looking back and recognizing and remembering those heroes that, you know, did what they did, I think it just gives you a better sense of gratitude. And I think you just live a little better, you know. I think your bad days just aren't so bad when you think about what happened on that day. So thank you both, gentlemen, for your words and for your time. I had a blast. And that's it, you guys. I hope you guys give these guys the attention they deserve, man. Go follow them. You know, check in with them, send them emails, all that stuff. There, I put their information down here, so you know, I appreciate it. This has been Alternate Take. My name is Danny Rodriguez. Check us out on Instagram and all that other stuff. And I appreciate you guys, man. Peace.